Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. World, Middle East, U.S. and Iran have reached a deal to stop fighting, reopen shipping. Signing is planned for Friday, marking a potential breakthrough in a war that has roiled the global economy. By Josh Dawsey, Anat Pillad, and Benoit Fasson. Iran and the U.S. have agreed on an interim peace deal. The two nations announced Sunday a potentially major breakthrough after nearly 4 months of fighting that created global political and economic turmoil. A deal is set to be signed Friday, President Trump and Pakistani negotiators say. Trump had earlier indicated he hoped a deal would be signed Sunday. Neither side provided a specific list of agreed-upon details in the deal. Trump said the Strait of Hormuz would be reopened on Friday, indicating in a social media post the time was needed for purposes of mine removal. In an earlier post, Trump said that Iran's restrictions on shipping in the strait and the U.S. naval blockade on Iran would be simultaneously and immediately lifted. Following intensive talks, we are pleased to announce that the peace deal between the United States of America and Islamic Republic of Iran has been reached, said Shehbaz Sharif, the Prime Minister and lead mediator Pakistan, in a social media post. Both sides have declared the immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, including in Lebanon. The government in Tehran later confirmed the deal had been struck. The text of the Memorandum of Understanding has been finalized, said Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister, Kazim Gabrabadi. He said Iranian threats of attacks on Israel had put pressure on the U.S. to reach a deal. Trump on Sunday called on Israeli officials to cease attacks inside Lebanon, something Iran suggested was key to its acceptance of the deal. One senior U.S. official said that while the U.S. was hopeful a formal deal would be struck this week, there were still some details to be ironed out. As they work on final details in the coming days, negotiators will have to deal with detractors both in the U.S. and the Middle East. A number of conservative voices have urged Trump not to trust Iran, and likewise, hardliners in Iran have argued against cutting a deal with the U.S. But economic benefits to both countries, if a deal is clinched, could be significant. Since the war began in February, a jump in energy prices has driven up costs for millions of Americans, and the U.S. blockade of Iranian ships has throttled Tehran. The agreement is believed to pave the way for a 60-day period of negotiations over Tehran's controversial nuclear program, which the U.S. suspects could be used to develop a nuclear weapon. In exchange for curbs on the program, Iran expects access to billions of dollars of cash blocked abroad and an end to sanctions that have stifled its economy. Trump has repeatedly expressed optimism about a deal with the Iranians, even suggesting for more than a month that it was all but clinched. But repeatedly, talks fell apart at the last minute without sign-off from the Iranians. Trump has grown increasingly frustrated with the war, as it has driven up gasoline prices and driven a wedge between him and his conservative base. Trump said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal on Sunday that the deal includes an agreement from Iran not to obtain nuclear weapons, but there was no mention of this in his social media posts late Sunday. Trump also expressed no urgency to extract nuclear material from Iran, saying that could come later. We'll get the nuclear dust later on when we're ready to go in and do it. I'd say over the next month or two. There's no rush, he said in the interview. He called it harmless. Trump said he wasn't as concerned about changing Iran's regime as some of his critics. As far as regime change, I never cared about regime change. This is the third group we've dealt with, and this is the most rational group yet, Trump said. Trump said there would be strong inspections on the Iranians, but didn't specify how they would work. He said that Iran wouldn't be provided cash in the deal, but sanctions could potentially be lifted. We'll see how they behave, he said. Trump said he believed the naval blockade on Iran had worked, calling it more powerful than the hits. It was unclear Sunday night how the removal of this blockade, as announced by Trump, would proceed. The announcement of the deal was part of a rapid chain of events Sunday, as Trump was preparing for his 80th birthday celebration. Earlier in the day, Trump expressed extreme frustration with Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu following an exchange of fire between Israel and Hezbollah, which appeared to almost scuttle the sensitive talks. "Bibi shouldn't have done that," Trump said in the interview. "I didn't like it at all. They fired a couple of small missiles and missed their mark by a lot. They have to fire back. Then he'll fire back. Then the whole thing never stops in the Middle East," he said. But Trump claimed Netanyahu was supportive of the deal. "Bibi is okay with it," he said. "Why is it good for Bibi? Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon under any circumstances." Netanyahu had expressed concerns about the terms of a potential deal. Earlier Sunday, the Israeli military attacked what it said was a Hezbollah command center in the suburbs of Beirut after Hezbollah fired drones at Israeli territory. No injuries were reported as a result of the drone attacks. 3 people were killed and 15 others were injured in the Beirut strike, according to Lebanese state media. The conflict between Israel and Hezbollah militants backed by Iran has been a persistent hurdle to ending the Iran war. Similar Israeli strikes have led to tense calls between Trump and Netanyahu in recent weeks. Israeli officials were taken by surprise when Trump said Sunday in a social media post that there should be no more attacks by Israel anywhere in Lebanon, according to a person familiar with the matter. Trump also called on Hezbollah to stop its attacks on Israel. In response to an Israeli strike, Iran's parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, threatened to pull out of negotiations. The strike once again showed that America either has no will to fulfill its obligations or the ability to do so, he said. "If you do not have the will and ability to fulfill your commitments, it is not possible to talk about continuing the path." And on to our next article. Politics. Blood, sweat, and corporate sponsors. Trump hosts White House cage fight. The UFC event is being held on the president's 80th birthday, bringing in VIPs and corporate sponsors. By Alex Leary and Terrell Wright. President Trump hosted a cage match at the White House on Sunday, turning the historic South Lawn into a sporting arena where fighters pummeled each other, surrounded by thousands of fans and paid advertisements. The unprecedented event used some of the most iconic symbols of American power, the U.S. military, the White House, and the Lincoln Memorial, to promote the Ultimate Fighting Championship, a company that stands to profit from the fight's far-reaching exposure. Critics decried the event as gruesome and unbecoming, but the crowd, a mix of military service members, administration officials, and Trump allies, reveled in the unabashed masculinity of the scene, cheering on fighters and repeatedly invoking patriotic chants as loud music blared. Taken together, the spectacle symbolized the style of politics Trump has brought to Washington, breaking norms and snubbing elite sensibilities. After delivering a flurry of strikes that led to a knockout, middleweight fighter Bo Nickel credited Trump for having the balls to put on the show. The fights took place in an octagon-shaped ring surrounded by a metal cage. Towering overhead was a 92-foot-tall, 600-ton steel arch called the Claw. Trump had a front-row seat for the action, sitting next to the First Lady Melania Trump and UFC Chief Executive Dana White, a close ally. Mega Platform's CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Paramount CEO David Ellison, Republican lawmakers, and members of the president's family were also in the crowd. The White House was a main character at the event. Shortly before 8:30 p.m., cameras trained on Trump as he departed the Oval Office alongside White and walked to a White House balcony overlooking the scene. Fighters were filmed strutting through the hallways of the White House before they entered the octagon. the UFC set up a locker room for fighters in the historic Eisenhower Executive Office Building adjacent to the White House. The event took place on Trump's 80th birthday. At the start of the fight, a man in the crowd shouted at the president, "Happy birthday." Secretary of State Marco Rubio earlier described the cage match as a gift to the American people. But the event was streamed exclusively on Paramount, which requires a monthly subscription. Paramount's corporate owners have close ties to Trump. The military was closely integrated into the programming. Country singer Zac Brown sang the national anthem as military jets flew overhead and a military color guard stood at attention. The U.S. Marine Band performed throughout the event, and the UFC telecast showed live footage of U.S. troops watching the fight from their deployment abroad. Even by Trump's standards, the event is a rare spectacle, merging corporate interests on one of the most famous plots of public land with exclusive access to select VIPs. Sponsor logos from Bud Light, Crypto.com, Polymarket, and the mega law firm Morgan & Morgan adorned the stage. Officially, the event is part of America's 250th anniversary celebration. Trump and White have portrayed the event as emblematic of the country's rugged spirit. It was also a chance for Trump to project strength during a particularly challenging stretch for his presidency that included the war in Iran and rising inflation. Trump's approval rating is near a career low, and he has lost support among young men who make up the core UFC audience. This is the country of fighting. This country was built with a fight, White said in an interview. More than 4,000 people scored the most coveted South Lawn tickets, including members of the military. Hot, muggy weather threatened to complicate the outdoor event, and it began nearly an hour late under a threat of thunderstorms. The UFC had a meteorologist on site to track lightning, the only thing organizers say could have stopped the action. Sponsors will help the UFC recover at least half of the estimated $60 million cost of the event, and the publicity alone could be worth significantly more. The beauty of the event for UFC is that this will fire up their natural constituents and should energize potential new fans. The people who hate it were probably never going to be UFC fans anyway, said Peter Cipino, a media analyst at Wolf Research. Thousands of attendees on Sunday, mainly men of all ages and ethnicities, waited in line to watch the match on video screens at the Ellipse south of the White House. A large group shouted at demonstrators protesting the president. USA, they chanted, Trump, Trump, Trump. Some of Sunday's attendees said they felt the president had restored masculinity to the forefront of American culture. Luke Iyer, an 18-year-old from Vienna, Virginia, said the Epstein files hurt his enthusiasm for Trump, but he said America is culturally headed in the right direction again, straying away from focus on issues that he said went too far after the pandemic. Back in COVID, I felt like people started going crazy and overreacting, Iyer said. Now I feel like we're on the upward trajectory. For young men like myself, we're going to bring the American spirit back to everyone. Demonstrators stood in front of the Washington Monument with signs calling to end the war and to defy the Trump administration and its policies. Karen Francis, a resident of Fort Washington, Maryland, said the event's use of the Lincoln Memorial, the White House, and the military was a desecration to the country. This is our house, not his house, she said. This is disgusting. The UFC's White and Trump have been close since the early 2000s when Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City hosted UFC events, a boost for an organization that was unwelcome in many venues because of the brutality of the combat. After Trump left office in the first term following the January 6, 2021 riot at the Capitol by supporters trying to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory, Trump turned to the UFC as he mounted a comeback, appearing at fights and winning support from the largely younger male audience. Polls show waning support for Trump among young men. This is the UFC's reward. To me, that's the story, said Luke Thomas, a combat sports analyst and podcaster who is critical of Trump. I get why fight fans would look at this and think it's rad. It's the union with the Trump administration that's the problem for me. White has sought to play down the politics and said the event honors America and puts superior athleticism on display. This isn't everybody's cup of tea, he said. I don't love golf. I'd be shocked if there wasn't criticism. And on to our next story. Elections. AI deepfakes are getting weirder and harder to spot in the midterms. Wave of fake videos and ads fuels worries about misinformation. By Amrith Ramkumar. Political campaigns are employing artificial intelligence in a range of campaign ads to elevate candidates and attack opponents, fueling concerns that the wave of fake content will undermine the midterm elections. In recent weeks, one video portrayed Texas Senate candidate James Tallarico singing a rendition of My Favorite Things, praising transgender children, while another showed Mike Rogers, a Michigan Senate hopeful, as a Hulk-like fighter rescuing people from a collapsing building. There also was a viral video of Los Angeles mayoral candidate Spencer Pratt as Batman saving the city from an incumbent depicted as the Joker. The improvement in free AI tools has fueled an explosion of such content, worrying election analysts and politicians on the receiving end of the deepfakes, who say that many voters can't tell that some of the more lifelike videos are imitations. It just feels creepy to see this image of you on a screen that looks like you but isn't exactly you, said Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. The Democrat was recently depicted smiling and sticking out her hand while accepting campaign contributions from big companies in an ad paid for by a super PAC that supports her Senate primary opponent, Representative Angie Craig. Like about 30 other states, Minnesota has a law prohibiting election-related deepfakes. But digital content researchers say enforcing such rules is difficult because of First Amendment protections. Flanagan said her team is checking whether the ad breaks the law, but even if it doesn't, she argues that it violated the spirit of the law. A Craig campaign spokesman said Craig doesn't support the use of AI in political ads. A recent rollback in content moderation on social media platforms like Instagram is exacerbating the trend. Consumers are more likely to believe deepfakes that reinforce existing beliefs, and calling out the deception often ends up amplifying the original content even more, researchers said. We're in a perfect storm, said Danielle Citron, a law professor at the University of Virginia who studies the topic. It makes us even more polarized than we already were. The number of deepfakes shared on social media has grown exponentially, from about 500,000 in 2023 to some 8 million last year, according to cybersecurity firm DeepStrike. About 85% of Americans say political content created by AI will spread misleading information about the midterms, according to a poll from NPR, PBS News, and Marist University. OpenAI recently said it would work with the Associated Press and nonprofit Democracy Works to provide users accurate election information. Recent AI models that are capable of carrying out cyber attacks have fueled new concerns for the company and other tech firms. What's in production right now is already scary enough for a lot of election-related misinformation, said Andrew Jones, chief product officer for cybersecurity firm Adaptive Security. Researchers tracking AI-generated ads say Republicans are using them more frequently, with President Trump being one of the most prolific posters of AI-generated content. Some of the posts depict Trump as a Christ-like figure and showing former President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama as apes, fueling backlash. Trump later took down the video with the Obamas. Top Democrats, including California Governor Gavin Newsom, a 2028 presidential hopeful, are also using the technology. Through engaging posts and banger memes, we are successfully communicating the president's extremely popular agenda, White House spokeswoman Abigail Jackson said. There's a reason so many people try to copy our style. Our message resonates. In Texas, a political group aligned with Trump recently purchased the ad that portrays Tallarico, a Democrat, in a dress and apron similar to the costume worn by Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music, singing about transgender children. The National Republican Senatorial Committee, the congressional group that works to elect Senate Republicans, previously targeted Tallarico with an ad showing an AI-generated version of the candidate reading provocative old social media posts from his past. When the fake Tallarico says certain phrases like white man and pronouns, a deep voice repeats them for emphasis. The video includes a small disclaimer in the corner saying it was AI generated. The NRSC also sponsored a similar video taking aim at embattled Senate candidate Graham Platner, in which the main Democrat is portrayed reading controversial old Reddit posts with a disclaimer saying it is a dramatic reading. If Graham Platner didn't want rural Mainers to know, he called them racist and stupid, and James Tallarico didn't want white men to know he called them the greatest domestic terrorist threat in our country, they shouldn't have said it, said Bernadette Breslin, an NRSC spokeswoman. Ahead of Tuesday's runoff in the Alabama Republican primary for lieutenant governor, Wes Allen put out a video with an animated raccoon making several allegations, including that it lived with his opponent, John Wall, and slept in the same bed. The video was based on a public Instagram page connected to Wall that showed a raccoon inside a house and on a bed, an Allen campaign spokeswoman said. Wall said the raccoon was his fiancé before they started dating and that he has never owned a raccoon, claiming Allen's campaign has gone off the rails. This is one of the concerns with AI because it makes it easier for political candidates to lie and spread false information, he said. Rogers, the GOP Senate candidate in Michigan, went viral recently when a photo was posted on X depicting him with muscles bulging out of his shirt at a parade. The photo, which included a label saying it was made with AI, spawned more AI-generated images and videos of a buff Rogers and other politicians with enlarged muscles. The approach was reminiscent of the one with Pratt, a former reality television star who was portrayed as Batman in a video last month that showed Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass as the Joker. Pratt recently failed to advance to a runoff to take on Bass. And on to our next story. Central banking. Kevin Warsh wants the Fed to stop explaining everything. For decades, the central bank believed talking openly made its policy work better. Its new chairman believes the opposite, and his first meeting Wednesday is where he starts to prove it. By Nick Timorouris. Kevin Warsh boiled down his advice for the Federal Reserve before an audience of investors last year. Stop talking so much, he said. More thinking, less talking. For more than a decade, Warsh has argued that the Fed should say less. How much a central bank reveals about its thinking shapes mortgage rates, markets, and the cost of borrowing for everyone. Wall Street will parse Wednesday's meeting, his first as Fed chairman, for any sign of where he'll take it. As a Fed governor through the 2008 to 2009 crisis, Warsh had a front-row seat watching Ben Bernanke pioneer two of the central bank's biggest innovations this century, a far larger holding of bonds and a more systemic practice of explaining its moves. Bernanke was extending a shift Alan Greenspan began in the 1990s when the Fed first started announcing its rate decisions and signaling where they may head. Warsh quit in 2011 after souring on the bond buying and has spent the years since arguing the Fed took both innovations too far. Now he's in charge. The question is whether he proceeds as a revolutionary, a diplomat, or both. Whatever Warsh hoped to do on interest rates will have to wait. Inflation is running hot after the war in Iran sent up energy prices. The conversation at the Fed has shifted toward hikes, not cuts. It would be a near impossible setup for a new chairman to override, even if he wished to. That leaves two ambitious projects which are moving at different speeds. Shrinking the bond holdings could take years, and communications is where he can move first. Being fenced in on rates with no fights to wage there frees him to spend his energy on it. In Warsh's view, the central bank has buried itself on its own communication. It produces forecasts that markets fixate on and that box the committee in. Officials give speeches or interviews on every side of every question. Warsh wants the Fed to say less and let markets do more of the work. With no actions expected on rates on Wednesday, the attention will be on him. Will he submit a forecast for rate projections he disdains? How much will he say at a press conference he'd rather not hold? More courtship than chainsaw. Warsh faces the classic reformer's dilemma. The practices Warsh wants to scrap were built and defended by many of the 18 colleagues whose buy-in he now needs, and each tool has scar tissue behind it, built to address an earlier confusion or debacle. So far, insiders say his promised regime change has been kinder and gentler than feared, more courtship than chainsaw. That comes as little surprise to people who have worked with him and know his charming manner. Kevin has great political skills. Small p, getting people together, said Glenn Hubbard, who chaired President George W. Bush's Council on Economic Advisors when Warsh was a White House economic aide. He replaced none of the Fed's senior staff directors on arrival, a pointed contrast with the house cleaning some had braced for. One of his first hires was John McConnell, a speechwriter to Bush, and an early signal that a chairman who wants the Fed to say less still means to make his own words count. Warsh turned heads by bringing on an author of the Project 2025 Conservative Policy Blueprint into the central bank. But one of his earliest decisions was to personally ask Michelle Smith, who served as chief of staff to past chairmans Jerome Powell, Janet Yellen, Bernanke, and Greenspan, to stay. One might look at an org chart and underestimate her role and influence, Warsh said in a 2020 oral history, recalling the pre-dawn calls they shared with Bernanke at the height of the 2008-2009 crisis. Over three decades, Smith helped successive Fed chairs with differing styles hone the communication apparatus now wants to prune. The machinery includes a statement and press conference after each meeting, a steady stream of speeches from up to 19 policymakers, and a quarterly set of economic projections, including the polarizing dot plot on which each official mark where they think rates should go. The toolkit has become a global central banking standard, adopted because openness was judged to make policy more predictable and effective. The apparatus rests on an idea Bernanke laid out years before he became chairman. What moves the economy, the thinking goes, isn't the rate the Fed set at any given meeting, but rather the path investors expect it to take. When investors understand how the Fed will react, they do the adjusting themselves, pushing borrowing costs up or down before the Fed has formally moved. The talking, in effect, is the policy. Ambiguity has its uses, but mostly in non-cooperative games like poker, Bernanke told his Fed colleagues in 2003. Monetary policy is a cooperative game. The whole point is to get financial markets on our side and for them to do some of our work for us. The break with Bernanke isn't only intellectual. By Warsh's own account, Bernanke, newly installed as chairman in 2006, helped get Warsh named to the board that year. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Warsh then served as Bernanke's eyes and ears on Wall Street and Capitol Hill, sometimes introducing himself to lawmakers as an aide to the chairman underselling his Senate-confirmed job. They parted ways over the bond buying, and Warsh left in 2011. At his swearing-in ceremony last month, Warsh paid tribute to Greenspan, the chairman who made an art of being inscrutable. Bernanke was neither invited, according to a person familiar with the matter, nor mentioned. What Warsh wants instead is to get back to the DeLorean, to somewhere in the 1990s, where the Federal Reserve was more closed, where debate was hashed out internally rather than externally, said Vincent Reinhardt, who ran the Fed's Monetary Affairs Division under Greenspan. Forecasts have been abysmal. Warsh's wager is that the cooperative game went wrong. Officials publish forecasts, then feel bound to defend them long after the facts change. The projections harden into commitments that become harder to walk back. He points to 2021, when the Fed called the inflation surge transitory so often that, in his telling, it had inadvertently raised the bar to retreat. If you're not very good at something, you should do less of it, he said at a State Street conference a year ago, according to remarks reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. These forecasts have been abysmal. My dots wouldn't be perfect either, so I wouldn't give them. Warsh has a favorite image for where the Fed belongs. Since 2015, he has said central bankers should get off the front page and back on page B12 of the business section. The rate decision, as he put it last year, should be a dry six-paragraph item. Rates up a quarter or down a quarter, nothing to see here, written by a reporter you never heard of. He has thought about this carefully before. After leaving the Fed, Warsh was commissioned to review the Bank of England's communications. He pushed for more disclosure in some respects, publishing its policy rationale immediately and releasing transcripts after a delay, while cutting its meeting from 12 a year to 8. Real transparency doesn't always mean more, he said while unveiling its findings in 2014, but it should always mean better. Depending on his approach, Warsh could find company in the committee he now leads. Austin Goolsbee said last month that even before he became the Chicago Fed president 3 years ago, I wasn't completely convinced of the value of forward guidance, so some fresh thinking in that space would be a good idea. The Fed was poised to take up an overhaul of its communications last year, an acknowledgement that the way it does it now is at best second best. The effort ended up on the too-hard pile because none of the alternatives had broad support. I was never the world's biggest fan of the dot plot, but you can't beat something with nothing, then Chair Powell said in April. Warsh may have an edge Powell lacked. It is easier for a newcomer to discard a tool than for the person who spent years using it. That's why the most watched question Wednesday is the smallest sounding one, whether he simply declines to submit a dot. It would deflate the exercise without a vote, an act of omission rather than a fight. Reinhardt framed the principle bluntly. If you don't believe in the project, then doing the submission is false. The case that the central bank talks too much has a powerful witness in Reinhardt, who helped Greenspan begin to pull back the curtain and is now chief economist at BNY Investments. He has come to think the effort curdled into something performative rather than informative. In doing so, he said, it traded away the mystique that, under Greenspan and his predecessor, Paul Volcker, had conveyed its own kind of authority. Limits of a bully pulpit. Hubbard, the former Bush economist, faces the near-daily commentary from Fed officials as a management failure. This needs to stop, he said. A chief executive doesn't let a division head go give speeches contradicting company strategy. Reining in the Fed's freelancers to Hubbard is a manager doing his job, not a retreat from openness. But the Fed isn't a company, and the chairman isn't quite its CEO. A chair can ask for discipline, but the other governors don't report to him. Stephen Marin, a Trump administration economist, gave 30 television interviews during an 8-month stint as governor that ended last month, more than double all the other governors combined in that period. The post-meeting press conference also had its detractors. The ritual forced Powell to lock in his message before the meeting so he could be prepared for the camera. Its defenders see the discipline as a feature. It supplies a measure of accountability the Fed once did without. Scrapping the briefing, and the Fed would have to find another way to answer to the public it serves. That mattered less in the 1990s when a flood of cheap goods and labor into the global economy held inflation down and made central bankers' jobs look easy. It matters more now, with the Fed under political siege from both the right, which wants it to bend to the White House, and the left, skeptical of its closeness to Wall Street. Pull back the projections and press conferences, and that does make them less transparent and less accountable. And I don't like it, said William English, a former senior Fed advisor. Bond investors warn that the apparatus is holding up more than it appears. Markets trust the Fed not to lurch at every wiggle in the data because the projections give them an anchor, said George Sagier, a veteran global macro investor. That calm has quietly lowered borrowing costs across the economy. You take that anchor out, look out. Moreover, March may not be able to buy the quiet he wants, said former St. Louis Fed President James Bullard. If Warsh goes quiet while his colleagues continue to give economic outlook speeches, a kind of unilateral disarmament could take hold where the chair forfeits the bully pulpit. Going silent, Bullard said, creates surrogates for the committee, and the surrogates do all the talking. Routine local engagements by the Fed's regional presidents used to get little media attention, Bullard said, until the 2008-09 crisis sparked intense interest in all things Fed. Now a wire service reporter watching a Rotary Club lunch in Springfield puts the headline instantly in Singapore. Campaigning versus reforming. Whatever Warsh attempts, he starts in a delicate position not of his own making. After a year in which President Trump publicly hammered the Fed to cut rates and vowed his new chairman would deliver, anyone who took the job would arrive under a cloud of suspicion that he was installed to do the White House's bidding. Four dissents at the Fed's last meeting, Marin wanted a cut. Three presidents worried about inflation revealed a committee already braced to guard its independence. Warsh's own words haven't always helped. His call for a new accord with the Treasury Department last year reached back to the 1951 agreement that secured the Fed's independence. Some colleagues wish he had picked a less loaded term for what they hope is an overdue tidying of operational lines. Reducing the bonds on the Fed's balance sheet is another test of that patience. The committee might tolerate trims, but not the deep reduction some conservatives want. One Fed governor dismissed a return to the pre-2008 system as massively inefficient and stupid. A drawdown means the Fed would absorb fewer treasuries, leaving more for the market to swallow. Doing that, while long-term yields are already climbing, risks driving them higher still. It took 18 years to create this balance sheet problem, and we won't be able to fix it in 18 minutes, Warsh said at his April confirmation hearing. Warsh's instincts have yet to be tested by markets. He wasn't at the Fed for the 2013 taper tantrum, when imprecise communications about the Fed's intentions to dial back stimulus sent bond yields rising sharply, or for the 2019 funding market strains that ambushed a Fed that had shrunk its balance sheet only to find it had drained too much cash from the system. Episodes like those illustrate why the institution tends to reshape its reformers as often as the reformers reshape it. There is a big difference between an effective campaigner and being an effective reformer, said Ethan Harris, a veteran Wall Street economist. A new chair can refuse a dot or trim a statement in an afternoon. Remaking how the Fed talks and operates is the work of years, one less by decree than by persuading colleagues to make his cause their own. Even so, a new chair's leverage is never greater than at the start. On communication changes, Kevin Warsh would be wise to come in and say right away he wants to do something, Bullard said. Otherwise, he'll probably get steamrolled. And on to our next story. Exclusive, markets and finance. Charlie Javis has been seeking a pardon from Trump after defrauding J.P. Morgan. The entrepreneur sold her startup Frank to the bank for $175 million and was sentenced in September to over 7 years in prison for fraud by Alexander Saidi and Anna Marie Androidis. The entrepreneur, Charlie Javis, has been seeking a presidential pardon for a criminal conviction for defrauding J.P. Morgan Chase when she sold her company to the bank for $175 million. People familiar with the matter said. Javis and people close to her have looked to solicit support from people close to the Trump administration for a possible pardon, the people familiar with the matter said. A spokesperson for Javis declined to comment. White House officials are considering a plan for President Trump to issue 250 pardons as a way to mark the celebration of the nation's 250th birthday this summer, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Trump's willingness to issue pardons has led to a wave of requests for clemency, in particular from white-collar criminals. Javis's name hasn't appeared on a formal list of requests made to the Justice Department. A White House official said Trump is the ultimate decider in any clemency-related actions. Javis has been a thorn in the side of J.P. Morgan and Chief Executive Jamie Dimon, who have endured years of embarrassment and spent millions in legal bills because of the botched purchase of her startup Frank for $175 million. Javis sold Frank to J.P. Morgan in 2021, promising the bank it could have access to what she said were her 4 million young customers to pitch bank accounts and credit cards to. She was arrested in 2023 on charges of fraud after the bank found she had doctored a list of customers and only had a fraction of the number of customers that she had claimed to have. Prosecutors said that she intentionally created bogus evidence that showed her company had millions of customers who didn't actually exist. A jury found her guilty on 4 counts of fraud, and Javis was sentenced in September to more than 7 years in prison. She is appealing the verdict and has long alleged that her prosecution has been unfair. After she was arrested, Javis's attorneys have argued that the Justice Department had improperly colluded with J.P. Morgan to bring a criminal case against her. The government has worked hand in glove with J.P. Morgan, receiving curated sets of documents, according access to witnesses, and suggestions as to targets for third-party subpoenas, her then-attorney Alex Spiro wrote in an October 2023 memorandum. The government is apparently content to ignore the highly relevant and likely exculpatory materials J.P. Morgan is strategically choosing to hold back. During the trial last year, her attorney also said she was unfairly prosecuted alongside her co-executive Olivier A. Amar. The effective double trial led each executive to produce more damaging claims about the other, thus prejudicing the jury against the defendants, the lawyer said. Even after her conviction, some of her original friends and investors have continued to support her, including Apollo Global Management's CEO Mark Rowan. Rowan was an investor in Javis's company and was one of only a few witnesses to testify in her defense during her trial. He wrote a letter to Judge Alvin Hellerstein pleading for leniency, arguing that she still had much to contribute to society. Earlier this year, J.P. Morgan sued a trust controlled by Rowan to try to recoup some of the money he had earned from the Frank deal. According to the lawsuit, Rowan and other investors in Frank refused to give back the funds it earned after her criminal conviction. The trust and J.P. Morgan resolved the lawsuit without disclosing terms. Rowan is also close with members of the Trump administration and was recently named as a member of the Board of Peace in an international effort to pledge billions of dollars to rebuild the Gaza Strip, along with Steve Witkoff, Marco Rubio, and Jared Kushner. Javis still faces a Security and Exchange Commission civil case and a continuing legal battle with J.P. Morgan over what it said were excessive legal bills that ran up to $74 million and included leases for cellulite butter and $530 in gummy bears. And on to our next story. U.S. backlash is growing over Kevin O'Leary's data center. He is blaming China. Shark Tank panelists blast his detractors on TV and social media as tools of Beijing. Some locals in Utah say the tactic is backfiring. By Will Parker. Kevin O'Leary is trying to build one of America's largest data centers in Box Elder County, Utah. That is, he said, if he can stop the Chinese government from interfering. O'Leary aims to develop a natural gas and data center project covering thousands of acres in the Hansel Valley. For weeks, he has encountered furious pushback from people across the state, largely over the potential impact on the Great Salt Lake, which has been receding for years. The entrepreneur-turned-TV personality said there is more to some of his local opponents than meets the eye. They are part of a propaganda campaign waged and funded by Communist China to stymie U.S. progress in the race for AI global dominance, he asserts. He has made his case during regular appearances on cable news shows and through social media accounts. O'Leary hasn't provided conclusive evidence of Chinese government involvement, and some said his Blame China campaign is meant to discredit his opponents. This hasn't caused him to soft-pedal his accusations. This is the CCP at work here, he wrote on X, referring to the Chinese Communist Party. There's no question about it. Data center development has sparked a nationwide backlash. Residents living near the sites of planned data centers fear they will sap their electrical power and boost utility bills. More than 90 local governments across the U.S. have enacted or are considering measures to limit their construction. In response to mounting opposition, many data center developers are keeping a low profile or taking a solicitous approach. Microsoft recently released its Community First AI Infrastructure Initiative, in which it pledges to cover electrical costs, replenish local water resources, and pay its full share of local taxes. A school district in Louisiana said some of its teachers would receive bonuses of more than $50,000 this year, thanks to increased tax revenue linked to Meta Platforms' data center construction project. O'Leary has said his project will return energy to the grid, create thousands of jobs, produce millions of dollars in tax revenue, and won't adversely affect the water supply. He has spent a lot of time railing against the project's detractors in a way rarely seen elsewhere. It is on-brand approach for the man on Shark Tank, known for his blunt and aggressive demeanor and called, ironically, Mr. Wonderful. It isn't yet clear if his allegations resonate broadly with the American public. He isn't the only one raising the specter of a foreign adversary opposing data center construction and slowing America's pursuit of artificial intelligence. In the U.S. House of Representatives, a group of Republicans this month wrote a letter to the White House asking the administration to brief Congress on investigations of foreign influence campaigns in the U.S. related to the development of AI. Still, one of O'Leary's targets in Utah said the Chinese allegations are already backfiring. It's really insulting to us, said Caroline Glitch, an environmental activist in Park City, Utah, who has posted videos on the possible threat the data center project poses to plant and animal life and the Great Salt Lake. The one thing he is succeeding at is uniting Utahns. After a request from the president of the Utah State Senate, O'Leary is already scaling back his initial plans. He will reduce the total size of the project to about 20,000 acres from the 40,000 acres he proposed in April. Yet after that concession, it doesn't appear that O'Leary will reduce the scope of the natural gas plant and data center, which he has said could grow to as large as 9 gigawatts of power capacity. That is enough energy to power more than 6 million homes. The first project phase is 1.5 gigawatts, O'Leary has said. A spokeswoman for O'Leary didn't respond to requests for comment. O'Leary, a former television producer and software publisher, co-founded a mutual fund investment firm and a venture capital fund. He later branched out into other investments, including cryptocurrency and wine. The 71-year-old Canadian rose to fame, picking among startup ventures on the hit television show Shark Tank. O'Leary had a supporting role in the film Marty Supreme, in which he played a hard-nosed businessman, not unlike his Shark Tank persona. More recently, O'Leary turned his attention to data centers, which he has described as essential to New York to national security. In 2024, he proposed a data center and energy project in Alberta that is still in the pre-construction phase. This year, he announced the project in Utah. O'Leary has yet to obtain financing or a hyperscale AI partner for the development. A statewide poll found that 53% of Utahns opposes data center, with 41% describing themselves as strongly opposed. Only 11% said they were strongly supportive. Not long after the community opposition swelled, O'Leary said he hired an international research team to investigate social media posts criticizing his data center. He said that he found several Utah organizations and individuals with funding tied to foreign entities, including China, and that he passed that information on to federal law enforcement. Gleick, the environmental activist, once ran for U.S. Senate as a Democrat. O'Leary said on NBC News in May that Gleick was being funded by something called Bear and Earthly Education, which he said were from Australia. Most people know that Australia has now become a vector for the Chinese, O'Leary said. Gleick denied O'Leary's allegations and said she hasn't taken money from Earthly Education, an environmental platform based in Sydney, nor from Bear, which stands for the Box Elder Accountability Referendum. It is a local Utah volunteer group that is opposing the data center. O'Leary said two local progressive groups that have made critical posts about the project, Elevate Strategies and Alliance for a Better Utah, are foreign-funded cells and are proxies of the Chinese. He alleged that they have received funds tied to a now-defunct philanthropy manager called Arabella, which he said was funded by the Chinese. He called out one of Elevate's co-founders, Gabby Finlayson, by name. Gabby, what are you doing, O'Leary said, and who's paying you? Finlayson and the Elevate co-founder, Jackie Morgan, said their consulting firm didn't receive money from Arabella or any Chinese-backed fund. We also always had a fairly respectful relationship with Republican leadership, said Morgan. We're not accusing each other of crimes like being a Chinese agent. And on to our next story. Politics, policy. Trump tries to outrun courts by building ballroom fast. The administration has been barreling forward with construction projects around the Capitol while litigation trails behind, by Lydia Wheeler. President Trump is blitzing through construction projects in the nation's capital faster than the courts can keep up. His signature White House ballroom project has run into legal problems, but has continued largely unabated. A government lawyer told an appeals court earlier this month that it is too late for the courts to halt the president's construction of the 90,000-square-foot building where the East Wing once stood. It's above ground, Justice Department lawyer Yaakov Roth said during a hearing on whether to allow the work to continue, They've installed like 3 million pounds of steel rebar, which is a lot apparently, and it's well on its way. Construction crews and vehicles have been streaming in and out of the White House complex for months. One recent evening, patrons at a nearby rooftop bar could see two high-rise cranes still at work until sunset. Nearly every project the president has undertaken, from his renovation of the Kennedy Center to the repainting of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool, and his plans to build a 250-foot arch near Arlington National Cemetery, is facing litigation claiming he sidestepped the public review process or that he failed to obtain congressional approval before beginning work. Even when litigant case files cases quickly, the deliberative speed of the legal system is little match for Trump's alacrity. There's no question that the government's strategy has been to move so fast that no one can catch them, said Alexander Kristofak, counsel at Washington Litigation Group, which filed a lawsuit May 11th after Trump, in mid-April, started work painting the bottom of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. In the case of the ballroom, the federal district judge blocked above-ground work on the project on March 31st after finding historic preservationists were likely to prevail in their argument that Congress must sign off on the project. The judge made an exception for the bunker and other national security facilities that are being built underground to keep the president safe in the event of an emergency. Trump quickly turned to a Washington appeals court, which allowed the work to continue while it considered the case. That gave the administration more than 2 months to work on the project before the court held a hearing, and the appeals panel could still be days or weeks away from issuing a decision about whether the project can proceed. The interim period has given the administration a reprieve and was able to drive an army of flatbed trucks through. Now the same judges who gave the administration that breathing room are fretting over whether they effectively tied their own hands. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.